With far-right parties gaining in its elections and growing unrest among its Muslim population, what does this mean for relations between France and the Arab world? We'll talk to Andrew Hussey, author of The French Intifada, The Long War Between France and Its Arabs.
There's a lot of anger out there, which is not just to do with politics and unemployment. It's to do with the very complex relationship with France itself.
What can you learn about policing in the inner city by embedding yourself in the heart of it for 6 years? I'll speak to Alice Goffman, author of On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City, who did just that.
When so many young people in the neighborhood have legal entanglements and any encounter with the police will result in their arrest and being locked up for they're not sure how long, that makes it really hard to use the police for what they should be there for, which is to provide public safety, you know.
My colleagues John Williams, Parul Sehgal, and I will talk about what's going on this week in the book business, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Andrew Hussey joins me now. He is the author of The French Intifada, The Long War Between France and Its Arabs. He is the dean of the University of London Institute in Paris, and he joins me now from Rabat, Morocco. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Hi. How are you doing?
So you're in Rabat doing some reporting.
Yeah, I'm doing some research for ongoing projects that I've got in Morocco and the Maghreb. So, you know, as you can imagine, what happens is that you write a book like that, but the story actually is always, it never ends, it's always ongoing. And I think the thing about North Africa at the moment is there's no such thing as an expert in North Africa because everything is changing so quickly, actually.
Right. I mean, it's this is a story that, a book that combines not only a lot of contemporary reporting, but history as well. You start the book off, though, in 2007 in the Gare du Nord in Paris, in a scene that you sort of accidentally walk into. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, this was a scene in 2007 at the Gare du Nord, the big railway station in the north of Paris, where, you know, I had no idea what was going on, and other people didn't as commuters. And so we saw this huge riot unfolding in front of us. And what was interesting about it was that the population of the rioters was made up mainly from the immigrant community who live in the banlieue, the suburbs outside of Paris. And you've got to sort of picture the Gare du Nord as a kind of frontier between the outside of Paris, where a lot of the North African and African and other communities come from, and central Paris. And what struck me most of all was two things. First of all, was the quality of the police, the severity of the police attacks on this community. And secondly, the chants that were coming in French and in English, nique la police.
We won't translate that.
Nan la boule à France, which is a kind of curse on France. And I thought, there's something political here that I don't quite understand. And that's what I wanted to try and explain in the book.
The population in the banlieue, which we should probably explain to people who are not familiar with France, is it's sort of the opposite of New York and London, where the inner city is, or rather the opposite of New York, where the inner city is in Paris, the sort of very nice area of the city, and all of the banlieue, the suburbs, for the most part, with a few exceptions, are where the poor and immigrant communities live.
I was going to say, you've explained that very well, because banlieue is often badly translated as suburb, which gives the idea that it's a kind of nice, bucolic place to be. It's not actually. All French cities are surrounded by, ringed by banlieue, which are actually have more in common with the kind of projects that you find in the States or indeed in Britain than anything else.
And the population there is a very sort of combustible combination of a number of different immigrant and sort of refugee groups. Can you describe who exactly, who this population is in France?
Effectively, the population is made up of the people who would come from the former French colonies. So that could be way over in Asia, it could be parts of the Middle East, but predominantly they are North African. And I think that's significant because the way that we often understand North Africa, have understood North Africa, is always through the prism of French control of that region. And now with the Arab Spring, as all that kind of thing is breaking up, I think what's happening or has been happening in France as well is that there's a very young generation, a lot of unemployment, but who feel second and third generation disconnected from France, the mother country, both as the colonizing force in North Africa and as the controlling force in France. So effectively, there's a lot of anger out there, which is not just to do with politics and unemployment. It's to do with the very complex relationship with France itself.
You know, it's interesting trying to parse how much of this is economic, how much of it is cultural, how much of it is religious in nature. So what is the unemployment situation like in France and among this population of 5 million Muslims?
The unemployment situation in France is not good, but it's always been worse out in the banlieue, out in these projects, where the Muslim population has been excluded effectively from the central part of the city, often through bad urbanism, bad transport, and also through things like racism, poor education, and so on. So I think unemployment's very, very important here. But I'd like to emphasize that what this book is not about, it's not about a clash of civilizations. It's about people, actually. And it's about psychoanalysis, and it's about, in a sense, how the Muslim population of France has felt dispossessed and alienated, and now there's a second and third generation which is very angry. And the term intifada is important because it means a kind of shaking off of the Palestinian situation. And in this case, I think young people, young Arabs, young Muslims in France, kind of want to shake off the legacy of French colonialism.
What's interesting to me, too, in that is the cultural component, because there is, you know, France prides itself so much on having this, you know, even though there is a lot of regionalism in France, but having this strong national identity. But you describe among the Muslim youth a kind of rejection of this ideal.
It took me a long time to understand this, how France is different from Britain and America. And one of the key concepts is the notion of laïcité, which is that you must be a French citizen first before you can be a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist or whatever. And what this effectively means is that France is, I describe it as a kind of totalitarian democracy, in the sense that you must accept French forms of liberty and democracy or else. And I think what this creates amongst the Muslim, has created always historically amongst the Muslim population, is a sense of alienation, a sense of being subject to laws which they did not control or they did not make. So culturally, I think North Africans have always felt very conflicted. There's a love-hate relationship with France. They speak French. They grew up in French culture. But the French civilizing mission, La Mission Civilatrice, also imposes an artificial Frenchness which doesn't apply to the reality on the ground. So you have the absurdity of young people in North Africa during the colonial period, learning about our ancestors, the Gauls, up in the mountains of, you know, Berber, speaking parts of Algeria.
Is it true that among the Muslim population in France, though, that there used to be more of an aspiration toward that French ideal? Or was that always a kind of romanticized, perhaps condescending French perception of its minority populations?
I think there's two things at once. I think there was an aspirational generation through the 60s and 70s. And I think that was partly a romanticized French version of le bon arabe, the good Arab. But I think the other side of that was, in the present generation, a sense of disappointment and anger that this never went anywhere. And emblematic of this sort of historical shift was the group of Arabs called Haki, who effectively fought on the side of the French during the Algerian War. And when they came back to France, the mother country, as they thought of it, they were treated very, very badly. And even now, in France, there are campaigns to sort of, you know, give the Aki their full human rights, as it were, because they've kind of been forgotten by France and sort of left out of history.
Is this French ideal and the fact that the Muslim population is moving away from it, is it pushing them toward a more radical kind of Islamic politics and religion?
Fascinates me is prisons in France. And in the book, I discuss some of the time I spent in French prisons, which are effectively the engine room of radicalism in France. Now, what you'll find in prison in France is that the radical Islamist population is not exclusively North African. There are white working class French, young French people who are converting to Islam because they are so disappointed and angry at the state. One of the key flashpoints in France is not Paris, actually, is the city of Roubaix up in northern France, which is the poorest city in France. And it's the home to someone called Lionel Dumont, who's white, working class, blonde, blue-eyed, and effectively was the leader of Al-Qaeda in France and in the French prison system. And what this demonstrates to me is that Islam, or Islamism, Islamic radicalism, is something that opposes the secularism of the French state in a very radical way, and as a political appeal for all of those, including the white working class in France, who were dispossessed by what's been happening there.
You have some really shocking statistics that the Muslims are 70% of the inmates in French prisons.
It's impossible to know how accurate these statistics are, he said, undermining his own thesis. But it's important that the French government do not allow you to know what religion people follow, because under French law you can't do that. So you have the absurdity of estimating prison populations. You have the absurdity of there's no control over the reader material that goes into French prisons. Imams don't want to work there because they're targeted and abused outside in the places where they work. So you've got this wild Islam sauvage, which is very radical and a kind of street Islam. And how can I put it? The French do not know how to control this because their own... The prison directors I spoke to were in despair because French law forbids them from actually monitoring and understanding their own prison environments.
How much is the other statistic you have in there is that one I don't think many Americans are aware of, is that France, of all the European countries, has the largest Muslim population, 5 million out of 66.
Yeah, I mean, that would always make sense given the French relationship with North Africa, which is a vast territory and a predominantly Muslim area. I don't think there's any danger in the statistic itself. I mean, the book is not about fear of Islam or fear of Eurabia. I'm not talking about that at all. I think there's no ticking time bomb with the population, as the National Front would like to tell us. What there is, though, is, if you like, within that community, a minority of very angry and dispossessed, often young men, actually, prone to violence, who are shaping in a very dangerous way the future of French politics.
Right, but it seems that, I mean, fear does operate within the political realm, in that I would assume, or to what extent does this situation explain the rise of the far right in France and their success in recent elections?
Yeah, well, I'm glad in the New York Times that the reviewer points out that I am no friend of the far right. I'm, in fact, an enemy of the far right. But I do understand this. I do understand why white working class people in France feel betrayed by the prison of elites of the left and of the right, of the MP. And they feel that either the National Front speaks for them, or either, paradoxically, that radical Islam can speak for them. And those are two extremes which actually form part of the same matrix, if you like. There's been a betrayal of the white working class in France, and they feel very angry about it, and that's what's created this potentially very volatile situation. I should add that this is not the first time this has happened. This is the kind of thing that happened at the end of the 19th century during the Dreyfus Affair. This is the kind of thing that split France into during the 1930s before the Second World War. Historically, patterns are repeating themselves, just the populations have been changing.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Dreyfus Affair, because that brings up another issue that you talk about in the book, which is anti-Semitism. Obviously, France has a long history of anti-Semitism, but now it has what seems to be a new form. And I'm curious how you see those two strains. Do they work together? Are they in opposition? And what does this mean for France and its relationship with its Jewish population?
As I was starting this book, I did an investigation way back in 2008 into the killing of a young Jewish guy called Ilan Halimi, who was the phone salesman in central Paris, who was kidnapped, tortured and killed by a group out in the banlieue who called themselves Les Barbares. Now, what really shocked me is I went out into the banlieue to talk to people and find out what had been going on. It wasn't just a small group of people, Les Barbares, who perpetrated this. The whole community knew about it. And it was like there was a sort of secret code of anti-Semitism, which was a way of opposing the French state, which, rappers and young people would sort of reveal to me that France is an Israeli-occupied country. Now, that's obvious nonsense. But the thing about it is that it plays into a historic pattern of anti-Semitism in France. The population has changed, but it's always been part of French political culture, extreme political culture, to blame the ills of France on the Jews. But this takes on a new dimension when you introduce the Palestine-Israel conflict and the relationship with its Muslim population. But I would explain this in very simple terms. It's not new. At the end of the 19th century, there was a class called the petite bourgeoisie, which felt itself sinking oblivion, caught between, you know, the haute bourgeoisie who are moving forward and the working class who are moving forward. And the origins of a lot of French anti-Semitism lie in the late 19th century. And emblematic of this is the novelist Louis Ferdinand Céline, great novelist, pro-Nazi, Hitlerite, anti-Semite, who blamed all the ills of the French lower classes on the Jews. So there's nothing new there. It's just a new language for an old problem.
Obviously an ongoing, developing story. Andrew,
It's an ongoing story. That's why I'm here in North Africa now, trying to work it all out.
That was Andrew Hussey, author of The French Intifada, The Long War Between France and Its Arabs. Andrew, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
My colleagues at the Book Review, John Williams and Poral Sehgal, join me now to talk about the book business. Hey, Poral.
Hey, Pamela.
Hey, John.
Hey, Pamela.
Let's talk about this little tiny company called Amazon. There have been a lot of stories in the headlines. What's the latest, John?
Well, the latest in this ongoing battle between the publisher Hachette, which is one of the so-called big five publishers in the country, and Amazon, is that Hachette recently agreed to purchase Perseus, which is another fairly big publisher.
The sixth largest publisher in the United States.
Yeah, so if there were a big six, that would be one of them. This, people believe, will give Hachette a little more power in their upcoming negotiations with Amazon. All publishers are going to be negotiating with Amazon soon to redo contracts. And as in past years, there's a lot of controversy about Amazon wanting them to take sort of worse terms for them on ebook sales especially. And since Amazon controls roughly a third of the books market in the US at least, it can be difficult for publishers to push back on that. But Hachette has, and it's stood firm, but so has Amazon. And so Amazon has been doing things like telling customers that there's a longer wait for Hachette books, unlisting some Hachette books, and this has impacted even big bestsellers like J.K. Rowling's, under a pen name, her new novel, The Silkworm, which is a Hachette book.
By Robert Galbraith,
yes. So I think
this debuted at number two on our list, so I think the question is, you know, might it have debuted at number one?
Yes, and in e-books especially, I think that there are e-books lists where it barely cracked, the top 30, yeah. Which is just so strange for a book of that size, and when you took out Amazon's effect, it was obviously in the top five. So in ebooks, it's really being heard.
Also, ebooks skew toward fiction and particularly toward genre fiction, which, you know,
they do.
And
Hachette does a lot of that. And Perseus has a very strong nonfiction list. And so that's another thing I think that, you know, it diversifies it in a way that might help it.
Perseus has under its aegis several what we call imprints.
Including Basic Books, Perseus.
Public Affairs. And they have backlist titles like Friday Night Lights, which is, you know, a perennial bestseller.
Buzz Bissinger.
Yeah. But even that, Hachette has said that this was just sort of its long-term plan to diversify in the U.S. and that it wasn't done, you know, solely to help in its negotiations with Amazon. But observers are just saying that it will have that ancillary effect.
It's an interesting contrast with what's going on in Germany with Bonnier, where Amazon is also negotiating terms with that firm. And already there's been an appeal to government intervention.
Yeah, it's a worldwide issue. And I think that the bigger the publishers get, obviously, the more, for instance, Penguin and Random House, their recent merger has made that company, you know, a much harder party for Amazon to negotiate with or to fight with, because there are so many books that Amazon needs to sell in order to do its business. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether other publishers sort of follow Hachette's lead and dig in a little bit, or whether Hachette eventually folds to the pressure. I mean, something's got to give at some point.
But isn't there a question when you say that Amazon needs that to do its business? I mean, a lot of these figures I don't think are public, but we don't really know what extent books comprise Amazon's business at this point. And they're in so many different products.
And that's true. And Amazon is very secretive. Yeah. A very famously secretive company.
So we know nothing else.
<That's it>.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Alice Goffman joins me now. She is the author of a new book, On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
You are a sociologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and this book grew out of your thesis as an ethnographer and a sociologist. What was your research?
It started when I was a freshman in college,
And then it grew from there. I got a job as a working at a cafeteria, and from there I got to know the grandchildren of the women who I worked for at the cafeteria and started going back and forth to their neighborhood, which was a working class to poor African-American neighborhood, not that far from the college I was going to, which was the University of Pennsylvania. So I did this tutoring for a while, and then after a couple months, the young woman I was tutoring, her cousin came home from a juvenile detention center. He was 15. His name was Ronnie. And then he introduced me to his cousin Mike, who was 22, a year older than me. A couple of weeks after I met Mike, the police raided his uncle's house in the middle of the night looking for him on a shooting charge. So we started going to court dates together, and I started to realize that many young men in the neighborhood were sitting in that courthouse, going through probation, parole, living with warrants, some for major cases like what Mike was facing, but some for things like unpaid court fees or technical violations of their probation, like drinking. So I asked Mike if I could write about his life for my senior thesis in college, and he said, yeah. And so I started hanging out, and then I moved into the neighborhood, and it grew from there into a dissertation at Princeton and then this book.
Now, we should say that Mike is a pseudonym. You use pseudonyms in this group and in the book, and you also sort of disguise, for reasons that become obvious, exactly which community in Philadelphia you were writing about. But the Mike that you're talking about, this is the Mike who then goes on to become a major figure in the book, or is this a different Mike?
So I spent like my whole... basically my whole 20s hanging out with Mike and his group of friends, or visiting whoever was in prison. Yeah.
Who was his group of friends?
He was friends with a group of mostly unemployed young men who mostly had not finished high school. He was the only one who had finished high school. They were trying to find work, mostly unsuccessfully. Some of them were involved at very low levels in the drug trade, selling drugs, like hand-to-hand. And mostly they were just spending their time dealing with their legal entanglements, going to court dates, running from the police. It was this sort of fugitive life that I was seeing. They were teaching younger brothers how to run from the police. They were talking about strategies to evade the authorities. And it wasn't just the police they were avoiding. It was hospitals where the police are looking for men to arrest. It was their jobs. Their mother's houses became last known addresses. So I started to see this whole world of kind of living as a suspect and a fugitive through spending all this time with Mike and his friends.
Okay, somebody might come in from the outside and say, well, let's look at, aren't these neighborhoods ridden with crime? You know, why shouldn't they be considered sort of suspicious? Isn't it true that many of them were dealing drugs? How do you respond to that kind of argument?
That's really true. These are high crime neighborhoods, and violence is a really deep problem. One way to think about it is, like, is locking up, you know, two-thirds of young men starting from very young ages the best way for us to be dealing with the really serious problems that are facing these communities? I started to see young men like Mike and his friends not as the threat, but as people who were facing their own very difficult challenges. You know, so, like, one of the saddest things that I saw in this neighborhood was just how hard they were looking for work. So like Mike's best friend, Chuck, would look for weeks and weeks and then months to find like very low paying part-time jobs and never get a call back, never get one positive reply.
Was he a high school graduate?
No, he actually, he made it all the way to his senior year, but then he got into a fight with a guy in the schoolyard, another student who called his mom a crack whore. And then he got into this fight with this other guy and didn't hurt the other guy much. Neither were very well, very hurt. But the school cops charged him with aggravated assault. So then he spent his whole senior year in high school awaiting this trial for aggravated assault. The charges were almost all dismissed, but he became a high school dropout at that point. And then he had to pay court fees, which he couldn't afford. So then he had a warrant out for his arrest. So then he was living on the run as a high school dropout. So it's like, you know, the guys that I was going to school with in the middle-class white neighborhood that I grew up in were also getting into fights, and they were also driving drunk, and they were also using drugs, but they didn't emerge from their 20s with criminal records, felony convictions. You know, they were doing just fine. They were sort of protected from all of these things that they were doing.
So he was looking for work while all this was going on?
Yeah, he was, like, tirelessly looking for work. Like, I think the saddest day for me was the day that he just got so, like, desperate and humiliated after months and months of trying to find a job that he asked someone down the street for some crack to sell on credit. And it was like, he knew exactly how bad this was. Like, he knew how it had, you know, ruined members of his family and how likely he would be to go to jail and how much violence is involved in the drug trade. But, like, he was hungry and mom wasn't wanting to let him sleep on her couch anymore. So it was, like, just sort of this work of desperation for him. And so that's kind of how I started to see, like, people selling drugs, like, not as the enemy, not as people who deserve, you know, to be locked up for life. These are young men who are trying really hard and who, you know, deserve a chance at legal work, you know, and who aren't able to get it.
Is there someone in his life or within that system who says, you're not going to get a job if there's a warrant out for your arrest and you're not going to, you know, that sort of is showing a way? Or to what extent is there an awareness of options, or were there no options in his eyes?
He has seen the young people in his life get caught up with the law at very early ages, you know, and that, I think, does make you feel pretty uncertain about your own future. Like, his younger brother, Tim, was first arrested when he was 11, when Chuck was driving him to school, and the car came up as stolen in California. Chuck had never been to California. He was borrowing the car from his girlfriend. He wasn't sure which one of her family members may have bought the car from someone who had stolen it or whatever, but anyway, the car was come up as stolen in California, and then he was charged with receiving stolen property, and his younger brother, Tim, at 11, was charged with accessory and put on three years of probation with steep fees that he had to pay that he also couldn't afford to pay. Can we imagine a criminal justice system that is helping people to stay on the right path, is helping young people to stay in school and to work, rather than pulling them away from it, rather than making it very, very difficult to kind of do all the things that would make you a good person, you know?
You talk about, in terms of the policing and the criminal justice system, that there have been changes that technology has sort of wrought and enabled a different kind of policing. Can you describe that system of surveillance and tracking?
I did a number of interviews with police officers during this study and then also afterwards, including with the men of the Philadelphia Warrant Unit, and one of them was nice enough to sort of just bring me in and show me all the technology that they were using. And so, like, not just in the warrant unit, but in policing in general, we're at a very arrest-based approach. So, like, indication of good performance is, like, how many arrests have you made? Or if you're looking for people with warrants, how many warrants have you discharged? If your numbers are high, then you are informally rewarded or formally rewarded. If your numbers are low, then you're encouraged to sort of catch up. So the police in Philly are using what a lot of other departments are using, which is like tracking systems that allow them to plot on the computer anybody with legal entanglements in a neighborhood, so people on probation, parole, with pending court cases. Then you can go to those people and ask for information about whoever is on your list to round up that day. They have a system where they can track people's cell phones in real time. And they're also accessing, like, Social Security records, hospital administration records, electric and gas bills. And also, when they arrest someone, they ask the person to provide all kinds of information about where their kids go to school, where their mom works. And the more information that person provides, the lower the bail will be. So people have a lot of incentive to do this. So by the time a young man, like in this neighborhood, has been arrested a number of times, the police have just a huge amount of information about him that they can use against him.
It's interesting because in other cities, there's almost an opposite incentive system where the police are encouraged to not arrest so that the crime statistics show up as, you know, falsely low.
I think that's a kind of interesting but small counter trend to this. I think what we mostly see is this much more arrest-based approach. It would be great if we could get to a place of police mediating disputes rather than making arrests. When so many young people in the neighborhood have legal entanglements and any encounter with the police will result in their arrest and being locked up for they're not sure how long, that makes it really hard to turn to the police for protection or mediation. It makes it really hard for people to use the police for what they should be there for, which is to provide public safety, you know?
Instead, you say that the young black men in this Philadelphia neighborhood feel hunted.
Yeah, and it's not just people with warrants. It's people who are on probation or parole because any encounter with the police could mean a violation and a return to prison. So So I talk about one young man, Alex, who was a very good friend of Mike and Chuck, who was very badly beaten. He was pistol whipped and he was robbed, and his jaw and nose were broken, and he was bleeding very heavily, and he refused to go to the ER to seek medical treatment because he was a few weeks away from completing his parole sentence, and he was very worried that going to the ER would mean a new arrest or a new charge, for example, for violating curfew or for drinking or for associating with known criminals or any of these things. So he got his cousin, who was studying to be a nurse's assistant, to come to my apartment and patch up his face, and he still doesn't speak the way he used to, and his eyes are not at the same level in his face, but he avoided prison by avoiding the hospital. So it's not just people with warrants, it's people on probation, on parole with pending court cases who feel hunted in this way.
You talk about, the fear that the young men in this neighborhood have of not only the police, but also other institutions, of hospitals, of schools, of anywhere where they, might somehow be exposed or get into trouble. So you, as a white woman coming in, were they suspicious of you?
There's this huge problem of the police using women to round up young men in the neighborhood. So, one officer told me, we might be able to see every guy with a warrant up on the computer screen, but when it comes down to it, you always go through the grandmother, the girlfriend, because she knows where he is and she knows what he's done. So like other women in the neighborhood, I was brought in for questioning. I was around when houses were raided, and during those times, the police really make you think that the men that you know are going to be taken into custody at any moment, and at that point, lots of potential crimes that you've been committing will come to light, and harboring fugitives, interfering with an arrest, all the crimes that are that come with being a woman who is linked to a man on the run. So certainly I think young men were suspicious of me the way they become suspicious of lots of women in the neighborhood, because the police turned to women to provide information in such a systematic way. Beyond that, what was I doing there, right? Like this white young woman from Penn. On the other hand, I had already known some of Mike's relatives through this tutoring that I had done. And mm-hmm. by the time I really started spending time with him, I had been around the neighborhood and he'd seen me with other people he knew for almost a year. So I didn't just sort of show up with a notebook and say, hi, can I observe your life?
Right. Did you feel that there was a move from seeing you as very much in the outside to a point where you felt like you truly were a kind of observer that they didn't necessarily notice, and you were seeing them in an unfiltered way?
I mean, you never stop being an outsider, right? I mean, the differences between us are gigantic, and also the police treated me really differently. Had I been a black man in graduate school trying to do this study, I would have just been arrested and put in prison, and that would have been the end of it right there. I really only got to be able to do this study because, as a white woman, the police did not arrest me while they were arresting everybody else around me. I mean, Howie Becker says, if you spend long enough somewhere, people just can't help but do what they would normally do, mm-hmm. they're every day for years and years. So I think there's some truth to that.
Did you feel incredibly pessimistic about this whole system upon completing your research?
In some ways, yes. But, I met people who just worked their butts off to avoid the police and the courts and to go to school and work every day, even as they're family members and neighbors were being chased through the streets. And, seeing people's resilience and people's just huge effort to make it through high school and get a job, not everybody could do that. Most people that I knew could not do that. But we're in this moment of where reform may be possible. Reform seems to be more possible than it was certainly when I started this study. So I was just reading in the Times that the two bills look like they are stalling, the recidivism bill and the smart sentencing bill. But that those even exist is really exciting. I mean, I think we're at a point where Republicans and Democrats are seeing that the system is too costly, that it is causing a lot of harm, that it is not serving the public good as it could be, and needs a major overhaul. So I feel cautiously optimistic about that.
Well, obviously could not be a more timely subject. The book, again, is On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City by Alice Goffman. Alice, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Greg Coles has Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Starting with the hardcover fiction list, there are 5 new titles on the list.
From the very bottom to the very top.
Exactly right. The very bottom, number 16, Linda Fairstein has the 16th book in a crime series about Alexandra Cooper, or Coop, who is an assistant DA in Manhattan. That book is called Terminal City. Fairstein herself, her readers may not know, spent more than 25 years as head of the sex crimes unit in the Manhattan DA's office. In this one, Coop is hunting for a killer beneath the tunnels of Grand Central.
She's been in the headlines, too, recently with the Central Park case, jogger case.
Yes,
being
that's
settled,
right.
And she was, of course, the DA's office.
Involved in that case. That's right. Then jumping all the way up to number 7 this week, there's an anthology, a short story anthology on the list called Rogues. Rare for short stories to make the list and rarer still for anthologies to make the list. But in this case, you'll understand why when I tell you who the editors are. It's Gardner Dozois, D-O-Z-O-I-S, however you pronounce that, and George R.R. Martin.
We're covering our bases here with the pronunciation.
This anthology includes a new story in the world of Game of Thrones. And so there it is at number 7. At number 5 this week, Jennifer Weiner has her first new novel in 2 years. That's called All Fall Down. It's about a woman in a struggling marriage whose career is taking off. She's also in the sandwich generation. She's watching as her father is suffering from Alzheimer's and her mother's also sort of losing her mind. To cope, she starts taking painkillers and becomes addicted. So sort of a mother's little helper sort of situation there. At number 2, a new novel called The Silkworm by Robert Galbraith, who it's no mystery.
Who?
That is, of course, actually J.K. Rowling. This is the second book in a series that she anticipates will be 7 books, as her other series also was, the Harry Potter books. This is a crime series featuring a private detective in England named Cormoran Strike.
And it's reviewed on our cover this week by Harlan Coben.
Yes, it is. Finally, at the top of the list on the hardcover fiction side of things, Janet Ivanovich's new Stephanie Plum novel is out. It's called Top Secret 21. Impressively, this is the 16th straight Stephanie Plum novel to make its debut at number 1. Every novel since Hot 6 in that series has entered the list right at the top.
Sounds like a record.
Then on the nonfiction side, there's just one new book this week. It is sort of a mathematical version of Freakonomics called How Not to Be Wrong by a math professor at the University of Wisconsin. And as it happens, my former dorm mate at the Breadloaf Writers Conference in Vermont, named Jordan Ellenberg.
Did he teach you how not to be wrong?
Many, many years ago, we were both fiction writers who had waiter scholarships to the Breadloaf Writers Conference. He went on to write a novel that came out in 2003 that, you know, was impressive. If we had to guess who might have been the first waiter that year to hit the bestseller list, we might have picked Jordan. I don't know that we would have picked it for a math book.
And would you have been right or wrong?
We would have been right and wrong.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.